I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A months-long FBI investigation into college athletic recruiting found its way to Lawrence, Kansas last week. Adidas, a sponsor of University of Kansas basketball, is charged with giving financial incentives to two of KU's student athletes. Today, we'll talk about what the implications might be for the Jayhawks and for the future of college athletic programs across the country. Then, 2017's tax day might be tomorrow, but it's not too early to start planning for this time next year. Our smart money experts return to tell us how the new tax bill will change 2018 filings and what we should be doing now to prepare. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. College basketball is in the crosshairs of the FBI, which is conducting a sweeping investigation into corruption. Now implicated for possible rules violations are some premier programs, including the one at the University of Kansas. The issue involves an Adidas shoe company executive allegedly arranging to pay players to induce them to attend universities that are sponsored by the apparel company. No allegations have been leveled, at least so far, against KU coaches or officials. The case, though, could wind up changing college sports forever. With us to talk about the probe and how it could affect the storied program at KU is Blair Kirkhoff. He's a longtime sports writer for the Kansas City Star. Blair, always good to have you here.
Good to see you, Steve.
Tom Keegan is a sports editor for the Lawrence Journal World. Tom, thanks for coming over. Nice to have you, too.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, let's run through some of the basics here, Tom. How big a deal is this FBI probe?
Well, I think it's a huge deal, and it's something you don't want your name appearing in, even if it's as a victim. You know, I think if you ask Duke who was a victim of Silvio De Sousa, I think Duke would tell you Duke was a victim of Silvio De Sousa in the tournament, but Kansas is a victim of Silvio De Sousa if he did indeed, or his guardian took money to forfeit his amateur status and then sign on a letter of intent saying, I am an amateur. That's where they get the term victim.
Silvio De Sousa, remind us who that is.
Silvio De Sousa is from Angola, and he has played over here at two different high school basketball factories. And he was able to graduate a semester early, so he did high school in 3.5 years, joined the team at the semester, and it took a while for the NCAA to clear him. And then he started playing very little and took him a while.
For KU, we're talking about.
Yeah, for KU.
Yeah.
Yep. And then eventually by the end, he really was able to help him, really did well at Sprint Center in the Big 12 tournament, and had a great game against Duke in the NCAA tournament. And he's in the indictment or saying that his guardian took money first from Adidas to pay off another shoe company that was sending him to another university, Maryland, Under Armour, and then enticed him to go to Kansas.
And Blair, the allegations now suggest that KU coaches, Bill Self, other assistant coaches, KU officials, didn't know anything about this. Do I have that right?
That's right. Kansas, in naming Kansas in this latest allegation from the Justice Department, no coach was named, and actually no player was named. When Tom talks about Silvio De Sousa, it's what the media has put together in terms of the timeline, the player. So Silvio isn't even named, and the Guardian isn't named. They're anonymous in the report. But that's right. Bill Self and none of the assistant coaches are named. And again, to follow up on something Tom said, that's where Kansas gets this sort of this victim spin, because none of the coaches are named, because the school itself isn't implicated. All of this has happened before the prospect or the recruit signed with Kansas, came to Kansas. And that's the problem. What the FBI is investigating, what they're looking into, are transactions that occurred before any of these kids signed with the university. Now, in some cases, there are assistant coaches who have been implicated, and and arrested back at the original FBI announcement in September. There are four assistant coaches who have been arrested for this, but Kansas wasn't named originally back in September.
You know, the sense around here, at least right now, Tom, is that because no coaches have been named, this occurred before the player actually signed with KU, that KU may not get hung up with any penalties or of any kind going forward. But you know, the NCAA has been down this road before in a case involving the big USC star running back Reggie Bush. There is a notion, at least based on past cases, that the NCAA has said that the university should have known, should have had a better handle on its players and what conduct was going on even outside of its direct purview. So is KU out of the woods here?
Well, no, I don't think KU's out of the woods. And it's so hard with the NCAA because you have the Reggie Bush case where they said that, and then you have the Cam Newton case,
right,
where the father was found to be shopping him around, and the kid knew nothing about it. But they since have put in a new rule that to try to get rid of that loophole. So you don't really know when you're dealing with the NCAA, which case do you look at? Where's the precedent? But also, it's true that nothing was found put in the indictment about the school or the coaches, and I think it's the only school, Blair, isn't it, that they don't mention coaches? You know, Coach A, Coach B, they call them by anonymous names.
Right,
but
right. And what's the other thing that's important to keep in mind here is this hasn't reached the NCAA investigative process yet. This is all
FBI.
All FBI. It's all a product of the FBI investigation. The FBI can't put teams on probation.
No, but it I think the NCAA would look pretty bad if they just say, well, we're ignoring everything the FBI has done.
No, but what I'm suggesting is there's a question of timing here. At what point does the NCAA get involved, and does the FBI just hand the NCAA its findings and, you know, its wiretaps, its conversations, and hand it to the NCAA, really basically having done the work of NCAA investigation, and then does that begin the process of schools being able to defend themselves as is custom in an NCAA process?
Or in any trial, you know, you have to let the defense.
You do.
Yeah.
That's right. But as we're talking about the NCAA and how it's worked with the NCAA, the school has an opportunity to defend itself. And again, that process takes a while as well.
And that's what we don't know. How much is the FBI sharing with the NCAA? Initially, they said they would, and we just don't know if they've done any of that yet. And the FBI or the U.S. attorney's going on its schedule,
right?
Not on the NCAA's schedule. So do you start the year next year with a player who may eventually, you know, be ruled not an amateur?
We're talking about the FBI's investigation into college basketball and whether KU will be implicated or not here. So the timeline right now, if I understand right, Blair, is that the NCAA, if it issues sanctions against any school, much less KU, it won't happen until when the college basketball season begins this year or even later.
Well, that's right. There's so many unknowns, including, is the FBI even finished with its announcements? I mean, this
right.
was the first one was in September, and that's when we learned about the 10 people, including four assistant coaches, who were arrested and charged. And then the second, then the college basketball season happened, and Kansas had a wonderful college basketball
right,
season
yeah.
with won its 14th straight Big 12 championship, won the Big 12 tournament, got to
the Final Four
for the first time since 2012, and then a few days later, the FBI comes, we hear the second announcement, and this is the one that captures Kansas in specifically along with North Carolina State, two schools that had not been named previously. So what we don't know is will there be another FBI announcement? Is the NCAA waiting for the FBI to finish? I've got to believe that the NCAA is in communication with the FBI, and the FBI is telling the NCAA, okay, now you can begin to act, but we don't know that.
Tom, let's slow down and back up a little bit and look for a little context here. Why is the FBI involved with this case to begin with? Why isn't the NCAA just handling this like it does at most cases involving its athletes and its coaches?
Well, the FBI has a lot more tools at its disposal than the NCAA.
It's wiretapping, for instance.
Subpoena, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can wiretap and stuff. And what is the end game for the FBI? Why are they in this? I don't know. I don't know why they chose this, but I know they can uncover a lot more than the NCAA can. So if the NCAA really cares about purity and amateurism, it should be begging the FBI for everything it has.
Yeah. Blair?
Well, this all started with one person whose name eludes me, but he's been identified as an Adidas representative who the FBI became interested in for reasons that had nothing to do with college basketball. The speculation is tax evasion. Well, in the course of the interview, this person said, "Well, I can give you, as is custom with people who talk to the feds,
right.
I can give you more information. I can give you information about what's going on in college basketball recruiting."
If so you go easy on me.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so the FBI listened to what he had to say and determined that there was enough to make this case against college basketball. And what we've what they have suggested, what we've read is that schools like Kansas and North Carolina State are being defrauded. As you mentioned earlier, Tom, they're being defrauded because these athletes who have been paid by shoe companies, Adidas in this case, the one that's out there, have basically broken NCAA amateur rules by giving money to the player's guardian or parent or funneled through the AAU team that this kid played on.
Right.
And so then the kid signs his athletic scholarship that says he has no knowledge of illicit recruiting. Well, that's not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not true. So the FBI is saying that that Kansas and other schools have accepted this player under fraudulent terms. As Tom said, I don't think Kansas feels victimized by having right. the talents of a player like Silvio D'Souza, but that's the case that the FBI is making.
Well, why is Adidas even interested in paying players who might be going to school to schools like KU? What's in it for Adidas?
Well, for one thing, KU and Louisville, great marketing for their shoes. They see these superstars wearing their shoes all the way into the Elite Eight, more than 50% of the time for Kansas. But for another thing, they pay these players with sort of an understanding. Look, when you get to the NBA, we have the first crack at you to negotiate a deal. But they want them going to the high-profile schools, and they're human walking advertisements, jumping advertisements for their shoes.
There's this other issue out there, Blair, that KU's on the brink of signing a major contract extension involving a shoe company with who else? Adidas. This is worth crazy money, $191 million over 14 years. Numbers that just drop my jaw here. What that contract is for what exactly?
Well, it was... Tom, correct me if I'm wrong. Was it last fall? There was a press conference in Lawrence where the athletic director and the president sat, and it may have been earlier than that. But anyway, they touted this contract and used it to sort of kick off a $350 million fundraising campaign for facilities, essentially mostly football facilities at Kansas. And this Adidas contract was going to be a large chunk of that. Of that income. This is how colleges operate. Big time college sports operate this way. But also, big time college sports have always had this black market economy when it comes to the high profile recruits. And it used to be boosters. We used to talk about the boosters and how boosters would pay make under the table payments for these athletes. Well, we don't see – the NCAA has successfully legislated that out of existence.
We think.
It's less than it used to be
yes.
because the shoe companies are now filling that role
right.
and signing players this way. And there has always been a gap in the value of the talent versus what the NCAA allows these kids to have. What they can have is the value of a scholarship, some other small perks that are available only to athletes. But their value, we know that their value is much, much greater than that. We know that.
$1 billion. A billion-dollar industry. And they're the products and the employees, basically.
That's right. And we know that their value is greater because $30,000 just exchanged hands between, the guardian of Silvio D'Souza, according to the FBI, and the shoe company. The NCAA or Kansas can't pay that money to Silvio D'Souza and his family, But Adidas can, and that's what Adidas did, and that's kind of where it is.
Well, I guess this all leads to the obvious question here, Tom. You know, is all of this, this controversy, going to change this whole notion of what amateur status is inside the NCAA and our college basketball players, like the ones at KU, going to get paid?
Well, it's a real complicated issue because of Title IX. If you pay the men, you got to pay the women. Maybe there's something they can do with licensing where if you sell a jersey with a player's name on it, maybe if he graduates, he can get a percentage of the money. If he gets a degree, you could do all sorts of that stuff, but there'll be legal challenges to everything. And also, let's say they do figure out something where, okay, you're a star, you should get more, so you get a percentage of the jerseys. Everyone gets a percentage of the jersey sales. All right, let's say that happens. Is that going to stop other third parties from, so I'm a billionaire and I went to Marquette, so I want Marquette to have a great recruit, so I'm going to buy a million of his jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to stop the cheating. There just isn't.
Right. As long as this value differential remains as pronounced as it is what you're saying.
Well, I think as long as anything. But, yeah, that's – when you have all this money coming in, you can't think that you can sustain a system where everybody gets rich off it but the product itself, which is the players.
What is it? There's the great chart that's floating around on the internet that the highest paid – state employee of all 50 states essentially is either the football coach or the men's basketball coach,
right?
In that state.
But again, the players get nothing out of that.
That's
deal.
Right. The players get nothing.
So the possible penalties here for KU, let's say KU winds up getting implicated in a best case scenario, I guess maybe because it should have known that something was going on here. What might come out of this? What might the penalty be?
Well, let's say that it is Silvio De Sousa and that he's ruled that he took money or his guardian took money, and that's whether he knew or not, the NCAA decides that means he wasn't an amateur. You go back, and every win that they had with Silvio De Sousa, it turns into a loss. And if that happens, there goes the 14th consecutive Big 12 regular season title. There goes the Big 12 tournament title, and there goes the Final Four. There, it would say vacated at each one of those. That's the minimum if he were proven that. And then, Blair, they could also put him on probation or limit scholarships.
Sure. All sorts of
West Virginia couldn't beat KU in basketball. Oklahoma couldn't beat KU in basketball. It'll be the FBI.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about here.
Or the shoe company.
Or the shoe company.
The next big date in the process of this is April 25th, because that's when the panel, the committee that has been established by the NCAA that is led by Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State, will make an announcement suggesting changes to not only to college basketball but to amateur sports. And
could that involve paying athletes?
It could. The one that's most obvious, the one that a lot of people talk about, is the one and done rule, where the very best high school prospects have to be – well, the NBA rule is that you have to be 19 years old to be eligible for the NBA draft, which mathematically means most of these top players have to play at least 1 year in college.
Right.
Kansas has had this recently with players like Andrew Wiggins and Josh Jackson. So there's speculation that the NCAA is working hard with the NBA Players Union and the NBA to eliminate this minimum age rule so that these – 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds who have aspirations of playing in the NBA can do that without having to go to college for at least 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
The other suggestion I think has a better chance of we see being implemented is the Olympic model, where athletes can sign contracts with Olympic athletes, Olympic hopefuls can sign contracts with shoe companies, with other products to endorse and maintain their status as amateurs and remain eligible in the eyes of the NCAA. And as Olympians, they remain eligible as Olympians as well. So I think we're more likely to see that come out of an announcement in the next week and a half.
I mean, this sounds to me, Tom, just like a giant mess. I mean, what a disgrace all this has become for college sports to be sort of racked up with FBI investigations and Adidas shoe company payments and all this stuff. I mean, this is just crazy.
Well, it is. And if you look at the way all the schools handle it, they're kind of, you know, Nike's motto is just do it. I think these schools embroiled in the Adidas controversy right now, their motto is prove it. Mm-hmm. Because they're not going to help investigate and really get to the truth of what happened and what their school did. No, they're going to wait and just keep their head in the sand and say, I have full faith. The chancellor of Kansas said, I have full faith in the athletic department. Well, here's the problem.
Is KU even conducting its own internal investigation as to what happened here?
Well, they're not hiring an outside firm. So they claim they've looked into it and they say, no, they're not. And here's the thing. When you just speak in statements that you prepared statements, and you don't take questions about it, oh, that creates more questions than it answers.
KU's not taking questions about this.
No, they're just releasing statements. The only one who takes questions is Bill Self.
And what's he saying about this?
He's saying so far it looks like we've done nothing wrong, that we have nothing to worry about, you know, like that. He always says so far, which you got to give him credit for that. But he's the only one who will ever speak without releasing statements. And, you know, it's amazing. He really is the face of the university. There's no question about that.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. Maybe stay in touch with the two of you as we go down the road here, because this story is not going anywhere. Blair Kirchhoff with the Kansas City Star, Tom Keegan, sports editor for the Lawrence Journal World. Thanks for the good update. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with our smart money experts on how you should begin planning for your taxes next year, even though tax day is tomorrow. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. The next tax law, which is going to affect this year, is going to impact millions of Americans, and that includes me. Now a look at what this means for you and what changes and plans you should make this year to prepare for the next round of taxes next year. And we'll look at how the new tax law and the changes there may impact charities and nonprofits that depend on donors for support in light of all these sudden changes in tax incentives. Our smart money experts are back to lay it out for us. They are Lucas Butchell, is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Sandy Weaver is a CPA and a Certified Financial Planner Certificate with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, welcome to you.
Welcome, Steve. Thank you.
And Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside and is a financial advisor offering securities and advisory services offered through a registered representative of Satira Advisors. Barbara, nice to have you, too. Welcome.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin, as we usually do, with a look at some current news developments in the world of finance, and lots of talk about tariffs and President Trump. What's the latest there, Lucas?
Well, we've instituted some tariffs on steel and aluminum, but everything above that has really been posturing and threats on both sides. In March and early April, the U.S., Trump, and the Chinese exchanged threats on kind of ratcheting up tariffs on all kinds of goods in the U.S., mainly impacting soybeans, aircraft and automobile industries. So lots of posturing and threatening, but not a lot of teeth in the tariffs at this point.
You know, Sandy, why does all this matter?
It matters because it increases the cost of the goods that we buy. So American consumers will have to pay more. You also have, you know, American companies who are trying to get access to China's markets, and they are huge. So we don't want tariffs when we try to sell things over there. But a big part of this is, you know, the intellectual property issues. You know, there is sound reason to say that in order to get access to China markets, our companies have to open the doors onto a lot of the innovation that we have. And China is very adept at copying what we come up with and ramping it up.
And all this, of course, when costs go up, what's going to happen to demand, Barbara, as you look at the overall picture here?
Well, as costs go up, demand falls. And ultimately, that could affect the whole economy. It could slow things down at a time when the economy is perking right along and growing very well.
Okay, so lots of stuff to keep tabs on here. Okay, let's turn to our main topic here, which is tax planning for 2018 and beyond, and maybe some strategies to take advantage of this new tax law. I mean, tomorrow's the deadline, folks. Most people know that. That's maybe the first thing to know. But some of the key changes in this law going forward are also pretty impactful. And maybe item number one to think about here, Lucas, is changes to tax deductions here.
Right. That's by far the biggest change. And it's important to note that the returns that people are filing right now are for tax year 2017. So the changes we're talking about today are going to be for when you're filing next year. But all the planning items you need to do and start thinking about are right now. Mm-hmm. And so deductions are changing significantly. The standard deduction was doubled for next year. So for a married couple, going from about $12,000 to $24,000 in the standard deduction. Why is that important? To itemize, you have to get above that standard deduction amount to make it worth your while. So what we're going to find is that 90% of taxpayers next year are estimated not to file with itemized deductions. So most people are going to be taking the standard deduction. So that really changes the incentives that most people looked at with itemized deductions.
And Cindy, that's a huge change. And so the whole notion of keeping receipts and stuffing them in a folder and then adding all that stuff up at the end of the year, all that goes away now.
Yes. Unless you can get over that new standard deduction hurdle, then you don't need to do that. On the other hand, you know, a lot of folks, we're taking this one by one with the folks coming in for their meetings. You know, the entire miscellaneous itemized deduction section on Schedule A got tossed out. And this might impact someone like you. You know, a lot of folks have non-reimbursed employee expenses. That's in that section there. Mm-hmm. A lot of people pay, you know, financial advisor fees, which we care about. That's in that section there.
So, in other words, you can't count it towards your deduction any longer.
You can't deduct it anymore. So you want to take a look at what other strategies can you use for that. Can you get that deduction moved elsewhere?
We're talking about federal tax returns here. Do you still have to keep all those receipts even when it comes to filing your state taxes?
Most of your state taxes start with a federal number.
Okay.
And then you have additions or subtractions. So it flows through. If you don't track it for the federal, you probably won't need to track it for state.
You know, and Barbara, I'm right on the line here. I probably won't have to keep all those receipts next year because the standard deduction should cover me. Does that mean that I can fill out my taxes next year on, what, a single sheet of paper or two, and I can do it without having to pay someone hundreds of dollars to help me do it?
I think that was one of the goals. Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, I can remember
the
during the congressional debates, they would hold up single sheets or postcards and say, if this goes through, this is how you will pay taxes in the future. I think for the first year, I would be cautious because especially if you're on the bubble, you know, married filing jointly, if you come close to that $24,000, you may still want to have those receipts and just see how it goes for 1 year. That's what we're recommending our clients do. If they're anywhere close, proceed as they did this year and just see what happens.
But to avoid the hassle, though, even if you go above the line by a thousand or two, that isn't enough money to me to make it worth my time to, you know, go through the whole standard, the itemized deduction process, right? I don't want to mess with that.
Right. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's going to be an individual call. How much trouble is it? What's your time worth? You know, do you want to pay your CPA, your accountant, your tax preparer the money? Many of them charge by the form. So if you don't want them to do that additional form, if you want to keep your costs down to have the prepared, to have your taxes prepared, maybe you don't do it.
Do we know how simple this new tax form is going to be? They're going to have to revise it, right, once this new tax law goes into effect. And I gather you guys haven't seen it yet because it's not out yet, right?
Yeah, we haven't seen it. I think it's safe to say it won't be one page. I think it may reduce it. But the 1040, which is the main form of the tax return, I think there will be some minor changes. I think really where you see the significant changes are on the itemized deduction sheet. So I think it's unrealistic, I think, at this point to say it'll be on one page, but I think it'll get simpler.
But in theory, you won't need an accountant to fill out your taxes anymore. Am I hearing that right?
Right. I think
it's pretty straightforward stuff all of a sudden.
Right. So if you've gone from taking deductions and having to go through that complexity to a more simple standard deduction, it does change the dynamic in terms of how much advice you need. And so that'll be an individualized decision. But yeah, most people that are going through a standard deduction, if you're comfortable operating basic tax software, you may not need to have a professional help you with that.
What's this going to do for business, Sandy? Your business?
Well, we don't prepare tax returns for our clients, but we review everyone and we recommend strategies. So it won't impact someone like me, but it does impact CPA firms. And it may be that, you know, they lose some revenue because of this. But on the other hand, though, there are a lot of people who are using TurboTax or TaxAct or other tax software now and going through a Schedule A. You know, unless it's really complicated, a lot of people can do their own returns now. The tax software is pretty user-friendly.
You won't need TurboTax to do it.
Well, no, you still would, I was arguing. And I'm not sure you need a CPA to do a tax return unless it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Barbara?
We do taxes in my office. And one of the things that we found is as we were doing taxes and then comparing this year to next year, you know, same set of facts, was that in the first place, most of our clients weren't claiming deductions anyway. But you have the comfort factor. A lot of people are very uncomfortable doing their own taxes. And this is a year of change. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with change.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't expect that we're going to lose a lot of tax planning clients, at least not year one. Now, maybe after they found out it was so easy they could do it themselves, perhaps that will happen. A lot of the people we work with own small businesses. So you've got a completely different set of considerations there.
If our listeners want to join our conversation, we're talking about the new tax code and how things are going to change next year compared to this year. If you want to join our conversation with a question about the Tax Reform Act or your own situation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's turn to charitable deductions, because that's being impacted here in a dramatic way, Lucas. What is the change? Can I still deduct the amounts of money I give to different charities, including KCUR?
The short answer is yes. Not really much has changed with the eligibility to give to charity. Again, the difference is if you were itemizing, you got an advantage. The more you gave to charity, the higher your itemized deductions were. If you're now taking the standard deduction, if you give to charity or if you don't, it doesn't change your tax situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may have a disincentive from a tax standpoint to give to charity like you used to if you aren't going to get the same tax benefit that you were always used to before.
How concerning is that, Sandy, to nonprofits all over the country right now?
I think it's very, very disconcerting just because they don't know how to gauge how much that has impacted past contributions to them. So they don't have a way to say, well, if last year we had $500,000 of charitable gifts to our nonprofit, what is this new tax bill going to do? Is that going to stay the same? Were people giving, you know, for a purpose altruistically? Or were a lot of those gifts, half of the gifts, were they because of the tax advantage?
And
they don't know.
This is a big deal for the nonprofit world.
A
huge level of uncertainty here being put into this thing. Barbara?
Anecdotally, I can tell you that we work with someone who is a professional fundraiser for not-for-profits in Washington, D.C., and her end of year was terrible because they did huge rushes. And maybe you guys saw these charitable contribution requests in your mailboxes in December. They really pushed hard to get money in December because of the uncertainty. They simply don't know. They are very, very concerned.
And we're not going to know until next April, what kind of impact this really was, right? A year from now.
I think they're going to be able to gauge as they do it through the year. As Sandy mentioned, some people just have what we call charitable intent. They just truly believe in what they support, and they will give anyway. It's the others who are really motivated by getting that tax deduction.
Okay. Sandy?
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. How about the personal exemptions that have been eliminated here? Lucas, tell us about that.
Well, that's kind of a pretty big piece that was kind of touted as, hey, we're going to double the standard deduction, and that's going to be great. and we're going to simplify things. But the thing that really didn't catch a lot of headlines or wasn't promoted was that they're taking away the personal exemption. And that was for each person filing and also their dependents, you got $4,050 effectively reduced from your taxable income for what was called a personal exemption reduction. They did away with that. So while they doubling the standard deduction sounds really good, taking away the personal exemptions doesn't really sweeten the deal that much because they gave you something here, but they took something away on the other side.
You know, Charlie from Twitter wrote us this: how does the new tax code affect 2018 home buyers?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that's going to be one that we see. A couple of things that I think will impact is, again, if you're a home buyer and you're really running the numbers to say, well, you know, I can afford this house, but I'm going to get the deduction for mortgage interest and I'm going to get the deduction for the property taxes that I pay. Again, if you itemize, you get all of those. If you don't, there is no tax benefit.
If you itemize, you get all those, but only if you go past a certain threshold, right?
Exactly. And that threshold was increased. And so whereas it was almost assumed that if you bought a home and had those costs, you would save money on your taxes. Now it's not so certain.
So the home industry, the real estate industry, has got to be really concerned about this too. Another level of uncertainty thrown into the mix here.
Right. Yeah. Because your more expensive homes, you had higher property tax, and see that area too. Even if you're still going to itemize, the taxes section is capped at $10,000. So, you know, at the upper end, that's going to impact the cost of a expensive house has gotten more expensive because of that cap. And then again, you know, you really need to know now, I think, whether you're going to be a standard deduction or an itemized deduction. I think it's important to know that now and going forward for the rest of the year because it changes some of the things that you want to do.
Yeah, Lucas.
Yeah, just one other thought on that. So there's been a lot written and said about how this is really going to change the home buying market. I'm really skeptical of that, honestly. I can tell you I work with a lot of people and you know, help them through home buying scenarios. Very few actually want to quantify the benefit of the tax savings they're going to get from the home buying. Most people are buying a home because they want to live in a certain area and they have a general sense on what they can afford. But rarely do people actually break it down to the penny in terms of the tax savings that they're getting. So I think there's a lot of stuff getting written here. I really don't think it changes the game that much.
Okay, Barbara?
But while we're discussing mortgages, it's probably worth noting that the home equity line of credit deduction was eliminated. And I saw an ad within the past 2 weeks about take a HELOC, home equity line of credit out, pay for college, pay for vacation. You can't. The only time it will be deducted, it now depends on the use. If you are making an improvement to the house, if you're adding a bedroom or an extending the property somehow, you can deduct it. What we're trying to figure out, and perhaps the two of you have seen this, but we're still researching this, is whether it was grandfathered on existing home equity lines of credit or whether it's new ones.
Yeah, for existings, let's say you took one out 2 years ago. You know, if you use that to build an addition on your house, you can still deduct that. If you use that to go to Vegas, you cannot deduct that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. 816-235-2888. We're talking about the impact of the new federal tax code. Won't affect you this year for taxes being filed by tomorrow, but it will affect you going forward into 2019. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. David from Lee's Summit. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. So my question is, with the standard deduction going from 12 or so thousand up to 24, 25,000, if you have the same income next year and the same charitable contributions, et cetera, if everything else in your return is the same, is that going to have a material impact? You know, are you going to see more or less of a refund or what you may owe? I'm just kind of curious what the impact would be of if everything generally stays the same with that doubling of that standard deduction.
In other words, you're asking if nothing changes, David, am I paying more or am I paying less, right?
Right.
Barbara?
Correct. One of the things that we have done throughout tax season, as I mentioned, 2017, same basic fact set, 2018. And what we're finding, David, is that people are saving money. Probably 3-5%, it appears, will be the reduction in their federal income taxes. So we think that most people will come out ahead.
Because Congress and the president touted this as a tax
exactly.
cut, and that's what you're saying is being reflected there,
yes.
Barbara. Yeah. Okay. Again, 816-235-2888. David, I hope that helped.
Yep, thank you.
You bet. Mary from Lawrence. Mary, you're on Up to Date with our smart money experts. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I know the IRS, I don't know if to state it probably correctly, but the IRS allows people who are required to take their required minimum distribution from their IRA. You can attribute or pay some of your charitable deductions from that RMD. But my question is, I think you have to be, you know, you don't have to take your own RMD until you're 70 and a half. But in my case, I've inherited an IRA from my mother, and I'm 68. So I'm just wondering, does the IRS allow me to divert some of my RMD from that my inherited IRA to charitable deductions and therefore then report less on my income, my distribution.
Mary, we're getting into the weeds here a little bit. Lucas, help Mary out here if you would.
Mary, the short answer is no. You need to be age 70 and a half, and it needs to be your IRA to take advantage of that qualified charitable distribution. But unfortunately not in your situation, but thank you for bringing that strategy up, because it is a really good one for folks that are over age 70 and a half. If you do charitable giving, really strongly consider using it from your IRA. Talk to your IRA provider because it can help you not just on your taxes, but also reduce your Medicare premiums potentially, which is a kind of a double benefit.
And we're recommending it too. And another thing, though, is the amount of Social Security that can get taxed. It can take that off, too. So, you know, sometimes if your income is high enough, up to 40 to 85% of that Social Security can get taxed.
Right.
You know, if you do a QC qualified charitable distribution with it, you know, you won't get hit with that.
Okay. Geraldine from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Hello. I have a simple question. Does the 25% tax bracket from 2017 dropped down to 22% in the new law?
Our experts are scrambling, grabbing their documents and homework papers to try to answer your question, Geraldine.
Geraldine, are you married or are you filing as a single person?
Single.
Okay.
70, and I'm still working, and I'm in the last year I was in the 25% tax bracket, so now there's a question: is my tax obligation is going to be reduced to 22% this year?
Yes, your marginal tax rate will be reduced from 25 to 22%. You are correct.
Okay. All right. That was the question. Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk just for a moment. If you'll be claiming the much higher standard deduction, some strategies to improve your tax situation going forward. One thing, if you're claiming that higher deduction, you can stop keeping track of all those receipts and everything else. What other strategies might you guys recommend, Sandy, as you look down the road here?
You can, if you are paying a financial advisory fee, you can think about whether you want to take that out of your IRA instead. If you do take it out of your IRA, then it is not taxed.
Huh.
So let's say you have a financial advisor and you pay him $2,000 a year, him or her, whatever the bill is. You know, you can pay that out of your IRA, and it will not be taxable income. But there are pros and cons to that approach because, you know, and I just talked about this last week with someone. You know, on the one hand, you know, you do want to, you know, husband those IRAs because money grows in there the fastest of anywhere because it's tax deferred growth or the Roth IRA too. So you want to keep those accounts as big as you can. You know, you don't really want to be minimize those by taking expenses out of it. On the other hand, if you've got a pretty doggone big IRA, you know, that's one good way to pay, you know, some financial advice fees, you know, and not have to pay tax on it. It's as good as that deduction side.
Hmm.
So that's one.
What about the notion of lumping itemized deductions into a single tax year? Barbara, what does that mean?
What that means is a lot of people make their tax-deductible contributions to a charity in December. But rather than do it December to December, maybe move one December to January and then pick it up again December of the same year. So you clump them together to get a larger amount in a single year.
If you want to go above the limit for...
If you're trying to get above that limit,
yeah.
Exactly. Another interesting charitable strategy that we're encouraging clients to look at now is the use of a charitable donor-advised fund. And so basically,
what is that?
You kind of front load the charitable deduction. So you put in enough money for a few years. And the nice thing is maybe you put in $24,000 so that you can hit that. You get the deduction the year that you fund the charitable donor advised fund, but then you get to say where it goes. I want $1,000 to go here and a $5,000 to go here, and it can stretch it over several years. So you can make smaller donations as you might have in the past, but you got the donation, you got the deduction on the large amount that you put into the fund.
Okay.
We're going to be using this one, I think, a lot with clients.
Okay, back to some calls here. Robert from Lawrence. Robert, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, I'm wondering how this impacts self-employed folks that are filing quarterlies. Do they lose all those deductions, business deductions, self-employed health?
Yeah. Lucas?
Yeah, you know, for a business owner, you're still going to have the ability to deduct almost all of those same expenses that you did before. So those are still – you're still going to want to keep track of all those receipts, and you're going to have to still do your quarterly taxes. So not much has changed for you. If you are a pass-through entity, there was a kind of a nice addition in this tax law. There was a lot of discussion about it because of what we've seen here in Kansas with flow-through income not being taxed for a period of time. And basically where they settled out is you get a 20% deduction for pass-through, qualifying pass-through income. Now, there are some restrictions in terms of income caps, and certain professions are excluded. But generally speaking, there could be an additional 20% deduction for you if you're structured in a pass-through entity organization.
Well, thank you.
I hope that helps, Robert. Yeah. What other points would you guys make in just the few seconds we have left here, just key points about what all this new tax law is going to mean to people?
I think if you have some big numbers going through that miscellaneous itemized deduction section on your Schedule A, sit back and go talk to your CPA and see if some of those can be moved over to another entity. And I'm thinking about if you have a Schedule C, which the gentleman had just called, might be a sole proprietor, that would go on that one. You might have a Schedule E, which would be rental real estate. You might have a Schedule F, farming income. But sometimes some of those expenses that were getting deducted under miscellaneous itemized deduction, sometimes with a small tweak or a little bit of a change, those expenses can legitimately go over to those others entities and be deducted there. But your CPA could help you with that.
One big change, too, the 529 plans that so many parents, including myself, have used to save money for college, that's changed now. There's a greater use of those funds for K through 12 education, Lucas.
That's correct. So they expanded the use for those 529s, so up to $10,000 of tuition costs for K through 12 private school expenses can now be taken out of a 529 plan.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. Lucas Butchel, a principal with KHC Wealth Management, Sandy Weaver with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services, Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners over in Brookside. Thank you all very much for the update. Sure appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll find out just how safe our city's data is from hackers. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.